Okay, so we've been talking about what's really been the focus of our class so far this quarter. In four words,
how God made us.
Yes, that's right. So we've been talking about God's made us mind and body. We're getting into the relationship piece of it, and the homework, which we'll not try not to spend too much time on. Certainly, the depression piece of this is not the focus of our class right now. But this video from a secular expert, Dr. Yapko, and I shared this video. I wanted us to see the biopsychosocial model in action. So the two questions that I asked were, any surprises in the data that he presented? And even though it's not from an overtly Christian perspective, does his basic model align with biblical principles? So, thoughts and reactions to the video homework.
I was surprised that there were people who weren't depressed after horrible experiences.
Okay, that's a good surprise, yeah. So how they processed that, what was huge for them. Good. Yeah, Katie?
It's like aligning with Christian perspectives. He brought up that point of how it's such a self-centered mindset. Like, you can't get out of your own head, and then everything becomes about you, and then that becomes...
Sure. Yeah. And we certainly have a compassion on people who that's the pit they've fallen into, and we'll try to help them out of that. But one of the really interesting... pieces of data about depression is how serving other people helps you out of depression. In fact, I believe the data is just 1 hour of volunteerism a month is enough to help depressive symptoms. That's not even very much, you know. I mean, so just that idea of serving other people should be a help to us, right? There's not going to be one magic bullet. I don't believe there's one magic bullet, but that's a very biblical principle. Getting outside yourself, serving others is going to should be helpful for us. Nancy, I saw a hand.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting how he talked about the biochemistry part of this and the biopsychosocial aspect is like 0.3 to 0.4.
You're talking about the genetic.
Yeah, in that component, because what was really meaningful to me in the Hope presentation was the way in which he showed personal responsibility in this, that there are things that we can do. And in my life, conversations just get shut down when people are suffering with depression and you try to talk to that person. When you don't understand, you know, this is a biochemistry, I don't use that word, but basically a problem that you can't understand, and so therefore, you know, you can't go anywhere with people. But he really shows through those 4 or 5 points that he made how there's a lot of personal responsibility that we can take, and it's easier for some people to do it than others.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. So that there are ways we can improve our thinking, that's the psychology piece, and I saw those as some of that was just like help people be rational thinking, right? Not globalizing. So I loved his illustration of someone doesn't return my phone call to nobody loves me, nobody cares about me, I'm a loser, you know, that kind of thing. So that's just trying to help people be rational. But some of it is very biblical, just biblical concepts of, oh, even just being fair, you know, and trying to be honest with ourselves, telling ourselves the truth, that kind of thing. Okay, Eric?
I think that's great news too, because that means that there are skills that I can work on, that I can develop, that will help me, right? If it were just something be completely beyond my control, which is that globalizing thing, you know, then there is nothing you can do, right? There's no hope then. But I thought some of the things he mentioned that were really helpful is the reality check piece, and how the social also wraps into that idea of reality check. And then the other one is, well, how I read that, biblically speaking, is truth.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking to telling yourself the truth, or having people who can tell you the truth.
Yeah.
And then the other one that really stood out to me is he said it, there's not such a thing as curing depression, but it's learning to manage your moods.
Yes.
The whole lifestyle, way of thinking, way of living. Kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Instead of seeing it so black and white, right?
Mm-hmm.
Certain people are going to have certain challenges their whole life. Or if they were to live another 50 years, they could maybe conquer it, but you only have 20 years to work on it, you know. So, you know, just growing in those things and the Christian spiritual principles that then supplement that so well, you know, and all of that. So, good thoughts. Terry, is that your hand?
Well, sort of, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I had a lot of thoughts. I thought the video was excellent. I do think we have to be careful, though, and I don't remember who said it, about the comment about serving, and there is truth to that. But if everybody's depression level is going to be different,
mm-hmm.
okay? It's a pit, right? That's the way I like to visualize it. Some people can be at the very bottom of the pit, some people can be halfway up the pit. And if we are, the serving part's good, and that's helpful. But sometimes if you say that to the wrong person, they can get that in their mind that that's all that's needed. And he talked about CBT, and he talked about medication, which was all excellent. But if we get to where we think we're just not serving enough, and that's going to take us out of our depression, that's wrong. It's got to be a combination.
Sure, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think it's helpful. He talked about every person's unique, so therefore their treatment's going to be unique.
Right.
And so it's super easy, I think especially maybe for Christians, to oversimplify it. Here's the magic bullet. You just need to, be praying more and serve more. And that's not meeting people where they're at. One of my biggest, I think I have it maybe on an upcoming slide, is this is not the video I would show someone in the pit.
Right.
That's not the purpose of it. If there's someone in this room who's really in the pit, that's not how my first several conversations would go. When you're suffering depression, I want people to see love. I want people to see the love of God. I want that God can help heal those sorrows, etc. Is it still helpful? Yes. I don't think anyone would be perpetually damaged by that. But this video is not for people in the pit. I do think it's a helpful thing for us. So in some ways, I think that addresses kind of what you're bringing up, that to just shoot off those magic bullets, it is likely not going to be helpful to people.
Because you said something about we can just study and pray it away, and that's not always the case.
Sure, yeah. And those should be tools that help us.
Right.
But it's not like God's given us this guarantee, if you read X, study X, therefore you won't have X problem. Right, that's just not how God's promises work. Okay, Tom.
Well, I was just going to say, I came out with the magic bullet and the two things that he said that I thought was very significant. One was medication is not the answer.
He would say it's a tool.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
It's
not the only answer.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And the second one was the best medication that you can have is exercise, which was amazing. You know, that is something that between those two ideas that you can go a long way towards moving someone, helping someone in that case.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't even know if you said exercise is the magic bullet either. The statistic he uses, same level of improvement of exercise versus antidepressants, but with a much higher or much lower relapse rate. So more effective in that way. So he would say it's a tool, just as I would say it's a tool. But, you know, psychology 40 years ago was saying it's the only tool, it's the only thing you need. And I think Christians were leery of that. And I think that now research is showing that it's just much, much more complicated than that. Yeah, Amy.
So I think this goes a lot back to what Terry said, that it totally depends on your perspective and where you're coming at. Because, I mean, like, for me, I see people in the pit, right? These are people that have gone way down deep in the pit. They're ready to commit suicide, right? Or they've attempted it. At that point, they can't think logically and rationally.
Absolutely,
that's
yes.
That's where those medications are helpful to bring them up so we can get to a point where we can talk logically and rationally.
Yes.
But it's never the approach that medication's a magic bullet. You need all the tools, but that medication certainly helps you get to a point where you can think clearly and logically. And depending on where you are on that spectrum, it may be necessary for the rest of your life just to keep you with that chemical balance so you can think logically and rationally.
Yeah.
It's very different from how it used to be, you know, and our medications have improved immensely.
He talked about that in the
yes.
video, yeah.
So it's not exactly the same.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that the medicine piece, and basically his approach to medicine is approximately what I would say as well. If the medicine piece can help us be more rational, that's a blessing, and you know that's just huge. There's an OCD guy who says I tried herbal supplements for years that helped relax me, but it wasn't the mental medication that helped me be more rational. That's a good goal. If it can help us actually. Be rational and reasonable, that's a blessing. So I think that to me seems very biblical of a help there. Now, we're getting off the medication piece. Let's at least bring it back in a second back to just the other thoughts on the biblical nature of this. Yeah, Kendra.
Well, something that really stood out to me is like if a parent is depressed, there's a higher probability your kids are gonna suffer. And what I can't really give a black and white answer, but he did talk about depression being, I guess, learned
mm-hmm.
or something like that, or like the attitudes, but he did say there's like a genetic element to it too, but of course, I don't think he even has the black and white answer as to how genetics really play into it, but going on a little tangent, when I was watching the video, I noticed the video was made in 2018, which not that long ago, but I thought that guy should do a video like this after COVID.
Yeah.
And
I've
see
had
how COVID kind of affected it.
Yeah, well, we saw how COVID and isolation hurt people, yeah.
Well, and I think during COVID too, something I really learned about myself is like, yes, I enjoy relaxing and watching TV, but I'll admit there were days I watched way too much TV. I don't even remember how many hours, but I got sick of it.
Yeah.
I think it really just shows God did not make us to sit around alone.
Yes, yes.
It's actually not good for your
no.
mind.
Yes, that's exactly, yes. Unfortunately, COVID was like a mass social experiment on isolation and television. Yes, absolutely. Good, okay, yeah, Dixon?
So just we haven't talked much about the rumination in this, and it's, you talked about, you know, the cure for that is some action plan together, and I thought that was interesting. Again, I realize there sometimes are so deep people that you got to help get them to that point, but there's a lot of emphasis put on just creating an action plan, being active, not sitting and doing nothing.
Yes,
and expecting whether it's medication or counseling or anything else
to do it for me. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an active part of that.
Let me pause on that point. So that's super helpful with both anxiety and depression, because when you feel stuck, there's nothing I can do. You know, I can't fix my job. I can't fix my marriage. I can't fix anything. Well, that of course you're gonna be depressed if it's just a hopeless thing. But saying what are things I can do, and so saying, oh, actually, what can I do to maybe improve my marriage or look at the job situation or apply for different jobs or you name it, whatever. Giving you plans of actions keeps me from being stuck versus there's something I can do. Now, when things are really bad, like in the pit, at the baseline, we always have God. So there's at least hope in that. I can at least say a prayer or note. But being able to do things and not feel so paralyzed and stuck just tends to be helpful for us. Okay, continue, please.
Well, I started to listen to another one similar to what Kendra's saying here, but just another one of his, I think it was a podcast that someone had done with him. And he referenced a quote of Abraham Lincoln. I thought this was really insightful. The best way to predict the future is to create it. And I think Abraham Lincoln was dealing with, if I remember right, his wife with depression, serious depression, you know, during his adulthood as well. I just wonder whether that you know, come back that this and there's lots of ways you can apply that into his life. You know, there's a lot of traumatic things that happened to him from losing his mother,
his son, and
wife, and all of those things. I thought that was an interesting and a powerful statement to me, for him to say that the best way to predict the future is to create it.
That
goes in regards to the rumination, the fact that we have to put an action plan together. We have to recognize that. You may need help doing that, but that's something that could really be helpful.
Yeah.
That's our responsibility for that.
Good. Let's take one more comment, then we're going to move on.
Jamie, before you do that, I'm sorry, we're all dishing out of here, and I don't want everybody panicking, but Jamie had some sort of...
Jamie aspirated on her meds this morning. Her oxygen tanked, so they're trying to help her breathe right now. They may be intubating her, I'm not sure, so we're heading to the hospital, but if you guys can pray for her.
Yeah, actually, Jason, you want to go ahead and say a prayer for
her
now?
Well, I was going to leave with her.
Well, then I can say prayer.
Yes, please.
Yes. And you leave when you need. I'm not saying you have to say. Father in heaven, please bless Jamie right now and bless the doctors there. Please, Lord, have mercy on her and on all the Lancaster family. Please grant her health and life and all the things we desire. Please, Lord, be with that situation right now and help, because we can do nothing, but you are a great helper. So please, Lord, bless this situation. I'm praising Jesus Christ. Amen. And why is my phone going off? Oh, Bartholomew County emergency. So you guys might be getting that in the next few seconds too. Like who's calling me at 11 o'clock? No, I'm in church. Okay, so yes, last comment here.
Oh, I was just gonna say, in response to Dixon's comment, that's where the therapy piece comes in. That's where, when you are down in that pit, meds can help you, but the therapy and the meds combined is really what's going to help you put that action plan in place, help you set your goals, and help you move forward. That's what counseling's all about.
Yeah, and hopefully what, and I've said this, hopefully what good counseling and therapy is really just wisdom, practical wisdom. Okay, I've seen a lot of people with your problem. Here's some things you can do that should help, you know, move you along to be doing that. Now, we'll talk about this in the pit, because one of our whole sections, number two, is how we struggle and principles of the pit and things like that. So, you know, we're going to be talking a little bit about that, you know.
Can I also say that when I say counseling, I mean professional counseling, because anyone can mentor anybody, but a professional counselor or coach will have education behind them that will know things that not just your average mentor would have.
Sure.
To help with the whole process.
Yeah, so some level of experience training along those lines. I think his presentation is more notable because he's not coming from a Christian perspective. You know, he's not Dr. Yapko, that is. Like I said, I don't think he's a believer. I tried to look that up. When he was going about don't trust your heart, don't trust your feelings, I was like, has he been reading Jeremiah 17? You know, because that's just so rare to hear that. Don't trust your heart, don't trust your feelings, don't be led by that. But anyways, it's certainly not from an overtly Christian perspective. He's trying to be scientific, so I think that's helpful. So obviously, it's not that I agree with every single thing he says. I'll say this, it's easy to talk about helpful treatments and helpful plans. It's very different to use them, to utilize them, to see them in action. You know, I remember reading a parenting book, you know, a book on disciplining your children, et cetera, when I was in high school. I was like, this is gonna be easy. I've got this book, and it has all the answers, and so, well, that's very different than, you know, one book versus when you're actually trying to live it out. You could read a Christian take on OCD counseling, and there's the chapter I'm thinking of that was not good. Oh, it looks good on paper, but that's very different than your typical needs and things out there. So it's easy to hear that presentation and go, oh, Yapko has all the answers. That's different than actually helping people, seeing those things in action, etc. And this is not the video I would show someone their first conversation if we're talking about their depression. Oh, you have depression. I've got this video for it. That's not at all how I would do that. But here's the point. He makes a compelling argument for a biopsychosocial approach to dealing with depression that I, as you've been in the class, I believe that that's how God made us. Biological factors, we should be aware of. Genetics, no alcohol. I know that we would like that point, right?
I liked that.
No alcohol, right? Get exercise, get sleep, get rest. Meds might help. There are thinking factors. How do I think about myself, my past? How do I process things that happen to me? Am I flexible or rigid? recognizing that mood impacts thinking, mood impacts decision making. I think that those are useful. Social factors. Are depressed people making me depressed? Or did I learn things from my parents that aren't serving me well, right? Am I comparing myself to others? That's towards the end of the video, right? Social media, not helpful. Relationship expectations. I think that's huge for us. Spending good time with good people. So, you know, that I think is very useful for us to see. And I'm glad that a lot of more mainstream psychology is headed this direction and not Freudian, not just you're a body without a mind, and so it's just a chemical problem. It's certainly bigger than that. Okay, so we have looked at how God made us, me by myself, mind and body, soul, spirit, flesh, heart, thinking, feelings, emotions. And we're getting into this whole thing about relationships with other people. So to review, when we say relationship, we don't mean how the relationship looks on the outside, right? If that friendship looks like it's a good thing. No, the point is it a legitimately encouraging thing? Not what it looks like or if it's friendly terms, but what's your heart in the matter? Or you might marry couples that look like they have conflict, but actually their relationship's fine. That's what they're used to, for better or worse, and that's still an encouraging relationship for them. It's really about if you have had or currently have supportive relationships in your life. And that, of course, is just in your heart, those relationships. And when we say relationship, we don't mean with living people necessarily. It could be, as you get older, that all the people whose relationships have been most impactful to you may be dead by now. It could be those parents and early friendships that were wonderful, and though you still carry that support with you still. It's really the people in your life you've had the strongest connection to, and sometimes it's just people in general. People in general bring us down in a way that I think we maybe don't appreciate. People more than we probably realize have a huge impact on our emotions and thinking and body. So I think this is the quote we ended with, but I think it's worth reading again. This is from Thompson, Soul of Shame. The mind is as relational as it is embodied. By this, I mean that the very emergence of the mind's capacity to do what it does is crucially dependent on the presence of relationships. And remember that Dr. Kurt Thompson, writing from a Christian perspective, his specialty is interpersonal neurobiology, that what our brains do in reaction to relationships, other people. From the day we enter the world, our neurons are firing not only out of the depths of where I'm coming from genetically, but in response to the myriad of social interactions we sense and perceive when we encounter other people. Babies need to be held. Babies need to be loved. They need to be talked to sweetly, all that. Not only this, but data from the field of epigenetics now suggests that human experience has a capacity to turn genes on and off, which itself is fascinating, right? In this way, our relational interactions can actually influence our lives at the most basic biological level. We'll get to this in a second. Thus, the way our neurological system wires its responses to various emotional experiences is significantly influenced by the relational context in which those emotions arise. Okay, so this is an article you can grab on your way out if you want to grab it. You don't have to. It's for your pleasure reading, for at your leisure. It's not the formal homework, but it's a good article. This is a well-known study. There's a Harvard study, and this is the Harvard write-up on it. But there's a TED Talk on it, blah, blah, blah. And so I'm going to read some excerpts of it, and then if you want the whole article, you can grab it on your way out. So Harvard did this huge study. By huge, I mean one of the longest longitudinal studies ever, 80 years from guys back at Harvard. JFK was actually one of the people, coincidentally, in this study. So think when JFK was back in Harvard, in the 30s or whatever. Studied them, their health over time, and then their kids and their health over time. And what they found is relationships have a huge impact on our physical health. Now, Yapko brought this up, right? The depression is a huge marker for cardiovascular issues. This is along the same line. So I'm just going to give you some quotes from this. What's the point? It's because this is how God made us. The surprising finding is that our relationships and how happy we are in our relationships has a powerful influence on our health. Close relationships, more than money or fame, are what keep people happy through their lives, the study revealed. Those ties protect people from life's discontents, help to delay mental and physical decline, and are better predictors of long and happy lives than social class, IQ, or even genes. So you don't need money or fame or good genes or social class or IQ. What you need for a happy, healthy life, the best predictor of that is close relationships. So this is fascinating. When we gathered together everything we know about them at age 50, it wasn't their middle-aged cholesterol levels that predicted how they were going to grow old, said Waldinger in the TED Talk. It was how satisfied they were in relationships. The people who were most satisfied in their relationships at age 50 were the healthiest at age 80. The researchers found that marital satisfaction is a protective element on people's mental health. No jokes, no jokes about that. Part of the study found that people who had happy marriages in their 80s reported that their moods didn't suffer even on days they had more physical pain. So in other words, you're 80 years old, you have a bad day of physical pain, that doesn't impact your mood if you have a good marriage. You have a bad marriage, pain impacts your mood, brings you down much more, right? Those who had unhappy marriages felt both more emotional and physical pain. Those who kept warm relationships got to live longer and happier. Loners often die earlier. Loneliness kills. It's as powerful as smoking or alcoholism. COVID, right? So loneliness kills. It's as powerful as smoking or alcoholism. When the study began, nobody cared about empathy or attachment, right? In the 1930s or whatever, when they were doing the study, they weren't doing this because science was honing in on empathy and attachment. But the key to healthy aging is relationships, relationships, relationships. So the question is, and you can read more about that, or you can read online or watch the TED Talk or whatever, but can we see God's wisdom in his plan for his people? Do we see God's wisdom in a family, marriage, not divorce, the church, etc.? I believe we can, right? That this is how God made us, and he knows how he made us. Kendra.
When you were mentioning the loneliness, but it kind of ties into what you just asked, how Dr. Yatko also talked about technology heavily affecting, you know.
More screen time, yes. Higher predictor of depression, yeah.
And it made me think of, like, you know, how there's so many streaming services out there now, and I'm not here to say how many you should have, I mean, you figured that out yourself.
Seven, the answer's seven, yeah.
But anyways, I do remember, like, when most of us were growing up, it was just cable. You know, they didn't have 10,000 streaming services out there. It was cable and maybe satellite. Maybe you had both. Maybe you had just normal TV. That's how it was back then. But then later I hear on some, like, video about just easy ways to save some money. The speaker didn't say how many services you should have, but she had a really good point. Like, do you really have time for that many streaming services? And that was, you know, really true. Do you really have time for that many? And I think it is kind of contributing to loneliness. Like, well, if I'm paying $15 a month for this, I better watch something on this service, and I better watch something here too.
Yeah, 15 would be on the cheap end, yes.
I'm just throwing out a number.
Yeah.
Even if it's $5, it adds up if you have a bunch of them.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, we bought a used TV at Goodwill for Julianne's surgery recovery, and we got YouTube TV for her surgery recovery, and it'll expire, and then we'll be done with it. So many channels, so little to watch. It's unbelievable how awful and pointless everything is out there. Betsy.
Yeah, looking at this and thinking about God's plan for his people, what it tells me is how important realistic expectations are.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not grounded in our relationship with God and expect all those around us to fulfill what he is supposed to fulfill in us, we will be depressed, we will be anxious, we will be let down. Just in his word, mercy, forgiveness, it's his plan that we do show, and that we will have to show, mercy and forgiveness, long suffering. So that's spot on.
Yeah.
He has provided for that.
Yes, that's right. End of Ephesians 4, kind, tender-hearted, compassionate, forgiving one another as God in Christ forgave you. That's how we're going to have good relationships, not the longer I live, the more bridges I've burned and all of that. So again, I can be living out those principles. Does God say, oh, well then you're going to have a happy marriage? No, it doesn't work that way. But we see that God's principles are going to be helping, should be helpful, and all of that. Was there a hand over here? Yeah, Pat.
It's also interesting on the other side that when someone's unfaithful, we withdraw fellowship.
To hope because it should be painful, right? That's the goal is, oh, those were valuable relationships. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is painful to not have that anymore. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of it's a tacit acknowledgement that losing relationships is a painful thing. Okay, good. There's a lot of ways we could go with that. So we desperately need stable and stabilizing relationships. And that's my favorite word to describe this, is that relationships need to be stabilizing. Stable, people you can can be dependable, people you can lean on. And then stabilizing, people who can be helpful and strong and encouraging, and that you benefit from those relationships. I don't mean selfish, I just mean like you're stabilized by those things. If we don't have stable people and stabilizing relationships, we pretty quickly fall apart. One of the guys, he's a preacher that I don't talk to him regularly anymore, but when we were talking, he had panic attacks, and he did great with implementing some things and grew out of that actually very quickly. The more I talk to him, his family situation is miserable, and he's doing his best to try to be a good son, but you know, his mom basically has bipolar, and she is very destabilizing to his life, right? She calls up and, why aren't you this, and why aren't you doing this for me, and well, of course he's gonna have a bad day. Like that, to have grown up with that woman and then now to have that is a destabilizing thing. Obviously he's going to be growing in that and growing in his relationship with God with all that, of course. But you can see how that would naturally be destabilizing if instead of a parent being helpful and encouraging, they are undercutting your life in that way. So we start off needing connection to our parents. No surprise, right? When we're very young, our parents or primary caregivers are our entire world, especially mom at first. And God's, you know, made babies to need that. You know, when the baby's first born, don't care about dad so much. You know, it's very mom focused. And obviously as they get older, their world expands. But were those relationships stabilizing or were they stressful, right? Could you lean on your parent to be stronger than you? I don't mean physically, I mean emotionally, to be there. You could lean on them to be there for you. A big word today in psychology is attachment, different theories of attachment. From your parents, and then like as you grow up and have a romantic relationship, what is your attachment style, things like that. But was that healthy? And you know, if the parent wasn't the parent and the parent needed the kid to be the mature one, well, you're putting the kid in a terrible situation there. I call this parental imprinting. You know, you've seen those videos, right, of where ducks get imprinted on humans, right? The first, they don't interact with their mom when they're born. The ducks hatch, come out of the egg, and then they see humans and they interact with humans, and then they think the humans are their parents. They think they're little humans with bills and feathers and quacks, right? So they're imprinted to, that's their reality, right? Well, parents, this is humans with human parents, they teach us what normal is, right? They teach us what is important. They teach us values. You know, hard work is what our family is all about. Or fun is what our family is all about. Or be at church, is whatever it is, right? Or what our true values are. And you may say your values are this, that, and the other, but the kids pick up what your family really is actually all about. Well, the challenge is then shaking off what your parents taught you to think about yourself is very difficult, right? So either verbally, literally, what they taught you to think about yourself or how they treated you, right? So you were abused by your parents. They taught you, not with words, but they taught you you're garbage, right? That's going to be hard to shake off because that should have been an encouraging, stable, stabilizing relationship. To change what your parents taught you about yourself, it feels like betrayal to your core values, right? I'm having to relearn that actually I am loved when it feels like a core value of mine is that I'm, you know, worthless, right? It doesn't matter if that core value is you're unlovable, you're worthless, you should be ignored. It's just challenging to grow out of what my parents taught me about myself. And it puts them at a very painful place to be. So we can probably all think of examples in our life with that. So I came across this quote from somewhere. I can't find it now. Maybe I dreamed it. I don't think I dreamed it. That the emotional pool you're swimming in is the quality of the 10 most significant relationships you've had in your life. That your general emotional well-being is those 10 most significant relationships, and were they helpful, stabilizing, encouraging, loving, or were they selfish, or you name it. And it kind of goes hand in hand with the fact we've talked about we're always in some kind of emotional state with that. So you can think about that. Maybe you want to think about it. What have been the most significant relationships in my life, and were those good? Were those healthy? Were those not? Well, of course, where we're going to be taking this is, what about our relationship with God, right? That's got to be key. Ideally, God is our most important relationship. Ideally, that's number one, right? Ideally, the top relationship out of those 10, number one is God. That'd be great, right? Ideally, God is the most stable relationship and the most stabilizing relationship that we have, right? You hear me though, I'm saying ideally, because we face challenges with that. We face challenges, and it just doesn't automatically happen. I don't wake up one day and God is the most
5-minute warning
important relationship, the top relationship, the most stabilizing relationship. I'm growing as a Christian, and I'm a new Christian, and my spouse says something to me, or my kid says something to me, or my dad calls me back on the phone, and I'm in a tailspin again, because yeah, I'm trying to grow in Christ, but my emotional impact from those relationships is alive and well, right? So here's your homework. Here's the actual homework. You can read the Harvard study for fun. Here's the actual homework for Wednesday. List at least 4 reasons that our relationship with God is not always our number one stable and stabilizing relationship. So some like related questions. Why it's hard to make God number one. Why that's a journey. Why that is difficult. What are things that keep us from making God number one? We know it should be, right? We're Christians. I know that my relationship with God should be number one. Well, what keeps that from happening? What can keep my relationship with God from being stable and stabilizing? So you're welcome to bring Bible verses with that, certainly Bible concepts with that, but just a good thought experiment of why isn't just automatically, easily, God number one, stable and stabilizing for us? Why is that challenging? What can keep that from happening, et cetera? So no responses yet. That's what I want you to think about and just brainstorm and think, yeah, what does keep God from being number one? What are some challenges to that? Does that homework make sense? Obviously, the goal of that is, as we think about this, then to ways that we can then grow in our relationship with God. What are ways that his approval is what does matter to me the most, right? Galatians 1. I'm getting into it. I'm trying not to give you answers, right? Okay. Yes, Nancy.
I was just going to say, the reason I think that's so important is because everybody's got their story of their childhood and, you know, things that have impacted them. But we have to see our story in light of God's bigger story.
Okay.
And this is what that does, is it causes us to think like that.
Nancy, you've been reading my slides. Okay. Relationships give us the story about ourselves. So we need to retell the stories about ourselves, because what my parents thought about me, what my best friend in first grade thought about me, what that bully on the playground thought about me, that's not the real story about myself, right? So who I am I lovable? Am I worthy? Am I respectable? Am I valuable? Is everything going to be okay? This comes from relationships. And obviously, it comes from some data from the Bible, but relationships retell the story about ourselves. And that's why we need God to be number one, right? Bad relationships give us a bad story about ourselves. I'm not worthy, I won't be loved, things aren't going to be okay. Good relationships give us a very different story. Life is good, I'm loved, cherished, appreciated, God's with me, everything is going to be okay. So, this is, of course, just such a biblical perspective, retelling my life story in the context of the greater truths that God has given us. Starts as thinking. I read the Bible, I think about it. It starts as thinking, but it turns into relational with that. Yes, Nancy.
Well, what's interesting is in the video, he says this in a way, because he says, we are more than our history.
Yeah.
We are more than our body type. We are more than, I thought that was really interesting.
That's right. I'm more than the likes I get on Facebook. Yeah. You know, that's not a good story. If your story is I'm a loser because nobody liked my Facebook post, that's a rough, I don't want to be in that story.
Or
answer my phone call. Yeah. So God then is able to, I'm a child of God now. I'm a son of God. That's a very different story than maybe the tone of my life growing up or you name it. So that's what relationships do for us. And I think that's very helpful. Again, is this slide the magic bullet for it? Well, no, but it's part of the package of what God gives to us. Obviously, class is about to end. Any other comments or questions? No more comments or questions. That's it. Thank you all.